Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Football History Rewind Part Number 37 is coming at you. And with the First World War raging on in Europe, the supply of able-bodied young men to play football was in short supply. But in order to keep the morale up at home, the games of college and pro football continued on, and we cover them in that season of 1917 in detail with some very intriguing figures coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And our journey through the history of football rules in this series has taken us up to the season of 1916 in part number 36. We talked quite a bit about Pop Warner and his days at Carlisle and University of Pittsburgh. Well, this edition will highlight some of the pinnacles of the game during the 1917 season, but will especially focus on another legendary pioneer of the game, one that we've recently talked about in our Western Pennsylvania heroes and contributions to football. Now, the 1917 season was somewhat uneventful in the area of innovation and rules revision. You know, the nation and the world had other things in our minds as World War I was raging on in Europe, and the U.S. would enter into the conflict in 1917 as information was intercepted by intelligence agencies that the Germans would use submarine warfare against American ships. A football would be played during this era of war, though, and Pitt, once again under Pop Warner's command, would be undefeated, but they would not earn the title of the national champions for 1917. Another legendary coach, oddly with connections to Western Pennsylvania, was be the top team in a nation. Yet John Heisman and his Georgia Tech Golden Tornadoes, they were called at the time, not Yellow Jackets, they would win the honors. Now, Heisman and the Georgia Tech squad had a lot of success in the two previous seasons, going undefeated in each, but they had the setback of a tie in each that prevented them from the national title coming their way. A powerful offense was the key to the Heisman coach teams, and this is quite evidenced in 1916 games. Golden Tornadoes defeated Cumberland College 222-0 in the most lopsided win in football history. I guess you might say the defense was not too shabby either. And we've talked quite a bit about that. We had a special on that defeat of Cumberland on our football history headlines on the anniversary, the date that it happened. And we also just talked about John Heisman about a week and a half ago. Look up John Heisman in the search box on pigskindispatch.com and you'll see it there. But we had a great piece on John Heisman, who is from Titusville, Pennsylvania. That's his Northwest Pennsylvania connection. Well, Pop Warner, you know, his connection was being coaching at the University of Pittsburgh. But Pop Warner was not born not too far from my home up in the Buffalo, New York area, which is only less than 100 miles from where I live here in Erie, Pennsylvania. Well, the history of this contest is most intriguing due to the fact that Georgia Tech was defeated in baseball, because Heisman was also the baseball coach and basketball for the school, but they were defeated by Cumberland 22-0 by a professional team from Nashville posing as Cumberland College. Now, that Cumberland brought in a bunch of ringers to go and play Georgia Tech that year. That fall, Cumberland dropped their football program, but the vengeful Heisman lured Cumberland with a guarantee of $500 of the gate to send the football team to play Jackets in 1916. The 16 players that ended up representing Cumberland were from a fraternity there and had little football knowledge. And Heisman not only wanted to avenge the baseball loss, but wanted to embarrass the sports writers who awarded the national championship to the highest scoring team. And it sounds like he accomplished these goals. the Heisman had been around football since 1886 when he played the game for a high school in Western Pennsylvania, Titusville High, and he went on to further playing his career at Brown University and later at Penn, where he earned a law degree that he never used. John went into coaching due to an interesting circumstance. During his last playing season at Penn, he injured his eyes in an indoor game at Madison Square Garden due to the galvanic lighting system used at the Garden at the time. The team doctor prescribed that he rest his eyes for a few years and not to work in law. Heisman followed the good doctor's orders and started a career in coaching as he became the first coach at Oberlin College in Ohio. He left there to coach at Buckdell College, now known as the University of Akron, where he developed a snap from center for football. Previously, the center would roll the ball back, and most of the time with their foot. It was a little bit cumbersome for the quarterback of John Heisman at Buckdell because his quarterback was 6'4" tall. So Heisman taught his center to pass the ball backwards between his legs in the air to the quarterback. And after returning to Oberlin for a year, he coached at the Alabama Polytechnical Institute, now known as Auburn. The transient coach then went on to Clemson from 1899 to 1903, and in 1904 was hired as the first paid football coach in the country at Georgia Tech, earning an annual salary of $2,250 per year, plus 30% of the net gate revenue for home games. Probably a pretty good wage for back in those days of the early 1900s. Now, Heisman developed an innovative concept called the jump shift, or better known as the Heisman shift, while at the helm of Georgia Tech. In the book, The Heisman, A Symbol of Excellence, Gene Griesman writes, and I quote, "Heisman's teams depended on speed and precision maneuvers to win. One of the best-known formations involved the jump shift, or Heisman shift, which he unveiled at Georgia Tech. That formation has been called the precursor of the T and the I formations. Heisman's teams did not huddle. The quarterback would call plays, and sometimes the teams would run a series of plays without any call," unquote. Heisman was a colorful character as a head coach, and according to the ramblinwreck.cstv.com, he loved the theater and even spent summers as an actor at Summerstock. Heisman used his acting ability to conduct an annual preseason oratory on fumbling and its sinful nature. Holding up a football, Heisman would ask his players, quote, "What is this?" "It is a prolate spheroid, an elongated sphere in which the outer leather casing is drawn tightly over a somewhat smaller rubber tubing. Better to have died as a small boy than to fumble this football," unquote. Quote by John Heisman there. Pretty staunch words there. If a player did sin and lose possession of the football, Heisman made that sinner bounce a football off a nearby fence 100 times during practice. Now, he was quite the disciplinarian, had a unique way, but he got his message across using that theatrical tone that he so enjoyed in when it wasn't football season. It's interesting to note that Heisman was not a true man of virtue when it came to the rules of football at the time. He would illegally hand signal plays to his team and seldom huddled from the sideline. Remember, you couldn't really coach from the sideline. It sounds like a foreign rule to us now, but they weren't really allowed to coach from the sideline. So using hand signals was extremely illegal, but he did it anyway because he looked for every advantage that he could. Now, John Heisman went on to become the first president of the New York Sportsman's Club, and later, after his death in 1936, the trophy presented by the club to the nation's top football player but bore his name. And that, with that award, this great man's name will live on forever in history. Yes, the Heisman Trophy, named after John Heisman. Now, we also want to talk about the professional level of football in 1917. Not a lot to talk about, but we have a couple teams that are kind of intriguing. With World War I raging, men to play football was sparse, but the game was still continued back home. Now, the Tonawanda All-Stars up around Buffalo area defeated the Rochester Jeffersons for the New York State title. Now, that seems kind of inconsequential. We really haven't talked much about the New York State title, but that was an up-and-coming league as there was a lot of interest in New York State coming about for that. You know, there was teams around Buffalo and Tonawanda, Rochester, and, you know, across the state they had, Syracuse had a team. But it's interesting because there wasn't a lot of games played that season. I believe Tonawanda, when they beat the Rochester Jeffersons, after that win, they only had a 2-3 record and became the New York State Championships. 5 games and only won 2 of them. One just happened to be a real important one, a championship game. Now, as far as the Ohio state title, that was won by the Canton Athletic Club. Also, some still call them the Canton Bulldogs. They would eventually become the Bulldogs, and some years they were called the Bulldogs, sometimes they weren't. That team defeated Maslin for the Ohio State title, and after Maslin had defeated Canton earlier in the season, I believe. Yeah, so that was an interesting thing there, too. So those teams, we know, are going to have some real importance just a few years later, but we'll get to that a few episodes from now when we get into the 1920s and the APFA. So we're sure glad that you were able to enjoy this little bit of history with us and that we could share covering football year by year on our Football History Rewind. This is part number 37. So next up next week is part number 38. And we're going to talk about the year of 1918 when some of the boys started coming home and football started to get a little bit more interesting. But just war was still going on for another year or so. But a little bit of change of pace here. So we'll get to talk about that more next time on a Football History Rewind, part number 38. But we have football history here on Pigskin Dispatch each and every day. Just because we're not doing a Football History Rewind going year by year, we still have a lot of football history coming at ya. Maybe you would be interested in getting an email subscription to have our newsletter each and every day, know about all the sports history going on for that day from all the Pig Pen sports websites, including Orville Mulligan Sports Writer, which is going to start to become very active again with some new episodes coming out very soon. Sports Jersey Dispatch, we have some great things going on there, particularly on the writing side of things that are in the newsletter. And of course, Pigskin Dispatch, we have two or three new items coming out every single day on the webpage and a new podcast each and every day of the year. So make sure you check that out. Until tomorrow, everybody, have a great Gridiron Day. We're taking a peek over at the chains and the down marker. It's fourth and long. We're going to have to punt the ball and get on out of here, but we'll have another series tomorrow for your football history headlines, so be sure to tune in. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. PigskinDispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast. PigskinDispatch.com is a proud affiliate of the Sports History Network, the headquarters of sports yesteryear.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.